Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and, of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check us out at theivybookshop.com. The right book is waiting.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 284, for Thursday, the third day of August, 2017. My guest today is Michael Botticelli. He served as director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy in the Obama White House. He was the nation's drug czar during the expansion of addictions treatment under the Affordable Care Act, a time that saw federal spending shift toward tackling drugs as a public health problem. Michael Botticelli questions the Trump administration's commitment to dealing with the nation's deadly opioid crisis, while the president continues a call for repeal of the Affordable Care Act. That 2010 law defined addictions treatment as an essential benefit that must be covered through insurance policies. Botticelli says that not mentioning the effect that ACA repeal would have on the nation's response to the opioid crisis was a glaring omission of the Chris Christie Commission that called for a declaration of a national emergency. Visiting here this week for City Lab Baltimore, Botticelli now runs the Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine at Boston Medical Center. He's also now a distinguished policy scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. So a lot of us now are familiar with the story of the opioid crisis and how we got here, the prescribed painkillers leading to addiction, leading people to the street to buy heroin because they can't get prescriptions. This is in some way a well-known story in America. But how long has it been with us? When did you see it coming?
We really saw this happening. I was in Massachusetts at the time, but really nationally, beginning in the early 2000s. And I have to say, coming from Boston, many of our communities and many of our folks have been impacted by issues of heroin for a very long time. So this, in some respects, was not a new phenomenon. But what ended up happening, we've seen this epidemic in waves of really kind of the overprescribing, and in some respects, kind of well-intended push by physicians to do a better job at treating pain. And, you know, unfortunately, we had a lot of pharmaceutical companies doing some pretty egregious, unethical, and in some instances illegal marketing of these drugs as non-addictive. And so we saw in the 2000s, you know, this steep increase in opioid prescribing. And it was almost perfectly paralleled by increases in prescription drug-related overdose deaths. So we saw, you know, pretty quickly the steep increase in opioid prescribing and the dramatic increase in prescription overdose deaths. But over the years, this epidemic, as you're talking about, has evolved. And kind of the second wave of this epidemic was really what we saw as this transition of people who started up by using prescription pain medication, transitioning to heroin. We saw the influx of very cheap, very pure heroin in all over the country and in parts of the country that had never had heroin before. And we saw people who weren't able to get treatment transition to heroin use. So 4 out of 5 newer users to heroin started by misusing prescription pain medication. And, you know, as we've seen deaths from prescription opioids level off, we've seen dramatic increases in overdose deaths linked to heroin. And then we're in now, I think, what the third wave of this epidemic is really about, with the emergence of these synthetic, highly powerful opioids that are illicitly manufactured and brought into the United States. So fentanyl is one of those where in Maryland, in Massachusetts, and in many states, we've seen this huge increase in deaths linked to fentanyl, which is estimated to be 100 times more powerful than morphine, either in the heroin supply, sometimes disguised as prescription pain medication. And because of the power of these drugs, often users don't know it's in the supply and can really, it really elicits an overdose response very, very quickly.
Why do those who distribute heroin with fentanyl add fentanyl to it?
So, you know, people have often asked me this. You know, one, it's very, very cheap. And I think to some extent, despite the fact that users may not know it's in the supply, sometimes there's a tendency for users to gravitate to certain dealers or certain parts of the town where they know there's some really strong stuff on the street. They might not know it's fentanyl, but they know it's really strong stuff.
I've heard a drug addict say, you know, if I hear of an overdose, I want to find out where it came from because that's for me. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've actually heard people say that.
You know, I'm in recovery, so I know a little bit about addiction. You know, and it's not uncommon for people who have limited money. You know, if you have $10 in your pocket, you know, and that's all you have to spend and you don't know where your next fix is going to come from, you want the most powerful stuff that you can find. So, but, you know, that can really translate, I think, to using these really, really powerful synthetic opioids without the user knowing it. So what we've seen in many states, including Maryland, Massachusetts, pretty much on the East Coast and the Midwest, this huge spike in deaths linked to fentanyl. So as I've said, you know, we're like in the third wave of this epidemic. Prescription opioids kind of started it. And quite honestly, you know, we still haven't gotten that under control yet. We've seen some decrease in opioid prescribing, about 20%, but we're still three times the level of opioid prescribing that we were in 1999. So our medical community still has a long way to go.
I was going to ask you about that. Have advisories gone out to doctors who were trained in pain management to pull back in some way or to, you know, adjust their view of this or their approach to patients?
There is no lack of guidance to the medical community around safer and effective opioid prescribing. The Centers for Disease Control issued a guideline for prescribers on chronic pain. Many of the medical community, medical associations have issued guidance to their field on it. Unfortunately, I don't think that has really translated fast enough to significant reductions in opioid prescribing. Again, it seems like we've at least begun to bend the curve and we're on the downward track. But again, you know, we are still at three times the prescribing level that they were in 1999. So, you know, everybody has a role to play in ending this epidemic, including the pharmaceutical industry and prescribers.
And I'm wondering if we declare a national emergency, which has been the recommendation of this commission to the president, would that be addressed? Is that an element of this? It should be, it seems like.
It could be. And you know, and I have to say, I'm not kind of a legal expert on all of the intricacies of the emergency, you know, the Public Health Emergency Act. But you know, as I looked at that recommendation, I actually thought that could be beneficial in a number of different ways. One, just highlighting the magnitude of the epidemic, really shining a light on this. A number of states have already declared state-level public health emergencies around the opioid epidemic. And I think the second piece is that it allows a level of flexibility and speed on enacting certain pieces of regulation or relaxing certain requirements that you might not be able to do as quickly as you would if it was declared an emergency.
For instance, Medicaid, for instance, may be affected by this. Medicaid for treatment of drug
addiction. Medicaid for treatment, you know, so there are certain things or certain rules around the size of treatment programs, for instance, that could be relaxed in a very expeditious fashion under the public health emergency. So I do think it warrants a closer examination and that there actually could be some potential value in the president enacting that recommendation from the commission.
Have you thought about what the impact of repeal of the Affordable Care Act would be on treating people with drug addictions in the midst of this crisis?
So, you know, there has been a lot of analysis that have shown the value of the Affordable Care Act and particularly Medicaid expansion and its role that it's played in increasing access to treatment for people, not just with an opioid use disorder, but who have a host of other medical conditions. You know, it's estimated that only about 10% of people who have a substance use disorder get care and treatment. And one of the biggest reasons that people cite is not having insurance or not having insurance that actually covers a good benefit. And we've seen in states like West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, some of those states that have been significantly impacted, the role that Medicaid and Medicaid expansion plays in getting people good evidence-based treatment. You know, we were talking previously about the recommendations of the commission, and like one of the glaring omissions, quite honestly, I think was not talking about the devastating impact that repealing the Affordable Care Act would play. You know, there were recommendations about increasing access to treatment and medication-assisted treatment. Well, the biggest way that we do that now is through the Affordable Care Act and through Medicaid and Medicaid expansion.
Well, it is the Trump administration.
It is, but, you know, I don't think, you know, then candidate Trump, you know, talked about this in New Hampshire and in other places.
How important it was.
About
to,
how
to
important
address the
treatment
crisis.
Was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can't simultaneously say with any sort of credibility that you're pro-treatment and that's going to be one of your prime responses and then simultaneously like put out call after call after call to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, and President Trump has actually called for repeal without a replacement. Right. So we're not even talking about, you know, what that might look like in terms of a replacement plan. But there is no disputing the fact that the Affordable Care Act has played a huge role increasing access to treatment for many, many people.
The problem is it hasn't kept up, or can't keep up with the rate of addiction. Right. People are new cases of addiction from the painkillers.
I think that many of our treatment programs are either near or at capacity. You know, we still hear of waiting lines and waiting lists for treatment. You know, and I always say, like, it's probably the last disease I know of where you have to sometimes wait weeks or months to get treatment. You know, if you have a heart attack, you don't have to wait 3 weeks to get treatment. And I think, you know, if you know anything about addiction, there's a sense of denial that goes along with it. And part of what you want to be able to do is to provide treatment when people want it. So you have to capitalize on opportunities when people want to seek treatment. And telling someone who finally decides that they're going to take the step to get treatment that they now have to wait three weeks. And, you know, and I think about not just the harm that might cause, but the overdoses that we've experienced while people are even waiting to get into treatment. So I think part of this is, you know, we still need to do a better job of expanding access to treatment. You know, I'm happy to say that before we left Washington in a bipartisan fashion, you know, we were able to work with Congress and pass legislation as part of the 21st Century Cures Act that gave states $1 billion over 2 years, because even with the Affordable Care Act, we knew that we still needed better access to treatment for many, many people. So, you know, I think Maryland and other states just got the first installment of that. So, you know, we're very happy that, you know, we're still able to provide states the critical resources that they need to, in essence, provide treatment on demand.
A few minutes ago while you were speaking, you might have heard sirens because this is not a soundproof podcast studio. We do the best we can here with foam on the walls from the House of Foam in Baltimore. But you hear the police sirens, which is a common sound in any city, but here in Baltimore, it often means, well, it could mean a fire. It could mean someone having a medical emergency and needing assistance from a EMT, but it could also be a homicide. It could also be a shooting, because we've had so many of them in the last 2.5 years especially. And I have a hard time sometimes separating in my mind when I try to think about this, why this keeps happening in Baltimore, why we have such a high per capita rate of shootings and homicides, separated from the opioid crisis. I have a hard time doing that. We've always had, as long as I've been in Baltimore, a heroin problem, and you acknowledge that. But when you think of new customers coming into the market for heroin, people who aren't familiar with city streets, aren't familiar with how the whole thing works, you know, what the system is for getting heroin, the possibilities for human conflict in those exchanges, in that commerce, seems to me heightens the possibility for shootings and homicides. I'm no expert on this, but that's just, there's a certain logic to that for me.
You know, I don't think you have to be an expert to understand that there has always been a nexus between the drug trading crime. This is a multi-billion dollar industry, for lack of a better word. And when you have that kind of money involved, you know, we have always kind of seen crime, both one, crime attached to people who have untreated addiction, but also crime and often violence attached to the drug trade. So it has not, you know, so it's not just public health that's impacted, it's public safety as well. You know, we were talking about the Affordable Care Act, and we talk about some of the health implications. But I don't think what we've really adequately addressed is the public safety implications when people don't get treatment, right? So we know that many people have untreated addiction, often turn to criminal behavior to support their own addiction. You know, as a person in recovery, I have my own criminal history as mm-hmm. it relates to it. You know, so you know, we know that the, you know, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act will have devastating health consequences, but it also has public safety consequences as well. When people don't get treatment, that's when we see criminal behavior. And we see the reverse when people actually get treatment. You know, one of the outcomes that we monitor for treatment is the decrease in criminal involvement. So, you know, while there's a nexus with the drug trade, you know, there has always been this nexus between addiction and crime. So it's why I think we often talk about this issue as both a public health issue and as a public safety issue. I think the challenge, quite honestly, and, you know, we experienced this coming into the Obama administration, that unfortunately our overall response to issues of addiction in many of our communities has been punitive. It's been arrest and incarceration. And we kind of have ignored the health focus. And I think what we tried to do in the Obama administration is pivot federal funding and policy to really reflect that this is a disease, that we can't arrest and incarcerate our way out of the problem.
Do you think you started that pivot?
We did, but it's very clear that that was short-lived. And if you look at, and one of the ways that we're able to tell that by is by looking at the total amount of money that the federal government spends on drugs, right? And there's a long history in our office on federal spending that we spent more on law enforcement and supply reduction, you know, eradicating coca in Colombia and building prisons. You know, what I felt, one of the things that I felt proud of when we left is that for the first time in the history of our office, spending on health approaches actually equaled our spending on law enforcement approaches. We were hoping that that trajectory would continue. But if you look at President Trump's proposed drug control budget, we see that going back.
Going up again?
It's
switching from health toward law enforcement.
Yes, building a wall.
Yeah.
Enforcement approaches.
And take the statements of the Attorney General Sessions, too.
Yes, going back to mandatory minimums.
Yeah.
As I said, we've tried that before, and, like, it doesn't work.
I thought we were supposed to learn from our history.
Yeah, well—
You know, Americans have. If you look at public opinion surveys about the war on drugs, 60 to 70% of Americans believe it's a failure— and that we ought to change our strategy.
You know, and we have the science and evidence to back that up.
And a lot of people have personal experiences with it, too.
Well, we do. And, you know, not only has it filled our jails and prisons, but it's, you know, it has been a disproportionate impact on people of color. So it just had devastating consequences to many of our communities and many of our families. And I think we were able to demonstrate that you could actually be smart on crime, that you could steer people away from the criminal justice system, you know, not have inordinately long prison sentences, create opportunities for people like employment and housing as they're coming out, and not have any increase in crime, right? So part of, I think, what you've got to base drug policy on is science and data, you know, not on fear. Quite honestly, and not, you know, and not on, you know, quite honestly, on racial prejudice.
Here's another question I have. Dr. Lena Nguyen in Baltimore has done a great job of getting the word out about saving people from overdoses from opioids. And, you know, there are problems related to it. Number one, the supply of the antidote. But I wonder, I've had this question. Yeah, I'm going to save my brother-in-law from, or my friend from dying, but then what?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like he should get arrested to go to a court to get a referral into a treatment program. But even then, there's probably a wait. But anyway, I just wonder if we do enough beyond saving lives in our approach to all this.
I'm a big fan of Dr. Nguyen and her approach to this issue. And, you know, as you describe this, this is a kind of complex and multifaceted issue. And you need a comprehensive response, right? And so part of that comprehensive response is, yes, we need to give people, keep people alive. And I think her basically standing order to everyone in the city to be able to carry naloxone is a strong piece. But I think if you talk to anyone, Dr. Nguyen, others, that part of that strategy also has to be to build treatment capacity. And I think this is why, you know, we were, you know, very appreciative of efforts here in Baltimore to expand access to treatment. We certainly knew that states and cities were hard-pressed financially and felt that the federal government had a responsibility to get additional resources out to states and locals to increase that capacity. So, you know, and overdoses can often be, you know, a pivotal point in someone's life. You know, it can be a significant wake-up call for someone. And, you know, we were talking about treatment on demand before. So, you know, that is often a great intervention opportunity. And so, you know, so you want to be able to offer timely treatment, you know, at those points of intervention, you know, and particularly when someone overdoses. So, you know, so our response to this epidemic, both nationally and at a local level, really has to be multifaceted. And you have to think about not only overdose prevention, but treatment capacity, recovery support. So even, you know, how do we make sure that people have, you know, safe and stable housing, have employment opportunities to sustain their recovery. So you really have to think about this kind of multifaceted response to this epidemic.
You know, something about this particular crisis that is hard for Americans to accept, even though there's a lot of awareness of it and response that we're starting to see, it speaks to something internal, a domestic problem. A lot of people still make moral judgments about those who become addicted, think there's something wrong with their character. You know, Americans, I don't know how good we are at looking at ourselves and facing up to problems. Mm-hmm. We think we're an exceptional country. We think that if a country is in distress, has been invaded, we'll go over there and help them out, and that's the American way. But we're not so good at looking at our own internal problems. Yeah. I don't think we're there. I think there's a lot of denial still.
I think that's particularly acute with issues of substance use for a long time. And I think because this issue has been kind of steeped in moral judgment, in stigma,
for
in
so
shame
long.
For a long time, that, you know, we deny it. We deny it as individuals. We deny it as families. We deny it as communities. And I think, you know, quite honestly, it's only been because the opioid epidemic has largely impacted a white suburban
It's reached suburban suburbs community, in rural areas.
That it's finally woken people up to the fact that many of our communities have been disproportionately impacted, but that substance use is real. And, you know, I feel like it's unfortunate that it took that to get us to this point. But at least I think we have a growing understanding of this as a disease, that it's not a character flaw. It's not a moral weakness. I will tell you, we were talking about the work that Johns Hopkins does. Johns Hopkins did this really interesting survey where they polled Americans on how they felt about people with a substance use disorder. And even though we've come a long way, there is still significant stigma that people have, so much so that it influences public policy. Right. So that people think that people with substance use disorder are less deserving than a treatment benefit, shouldn't be entitled to housing and employment opportunities. So, you know, even though we've come a long way on our understanding of this as a disease and not a moral failure. We have a long way to go, I think, in really changing people's perception on this issue. And we know that that shame and stigma often keeps people from asking for help. Or delaying care until their disease is much more acute.
So your four or five recommendations to the President of the United States at this point, you, Michael Botticelli, you've covered some of them, but if we were to make five bullet points, what would they be?
So I think first and foremost, understanding that this is a disease and that while law enforcement has a big role to play, that we have to continue to focus on health and public health strategies.
Number one.
That's number one. Second is preserve the gains and expand on the gains that we made with the Affordable Care Act in giving people adequate access, not just to substance use treatment, but to a whole host of medical services that people need to be able to do that. I think third is make sure that our states and locals have the resources that they need to be able to provide a comprehensive continuum of care for folks. I think we also need to continue to promote outreach strategies. So we know that many people are not ready to engage in treatment, but those folks are susceptible to overdose, susceptible to HIV and hepatitis C. So we need to promote things like syringe access services. Think about things like safe injection sites. We have, I think, a moral and ethical obligation to protect the health and care of our citizens and particularly those who are not ready to access treatment and move them along, create glide paths for people to do that. So I think that those are some recommendations that we need to continue to focus on if we want to make progress in this epidemic.
For the record, do you support the idea of the concept of safe injection sites?
Given the mortality that we have seen with this epidemic, and I think particularly with the emergence of fentanyl, that, you know, where people overdose in mere seconds, I think that we've got to really think about how we might implement safe injection facilities. I think the data that we've seen from Vancouver and other places, I think, show that it decreases overdose deaths. It can be a glide path to treatment. That it also has positive public safety implications, and that you don't see as many needles and potentially needles with HIV or other contaminants on the street. So I think they're worthwhile. I think the challenge is that even if we had a municipality or a state to step forward, they are still illegal under federal law. And I think the challenge is then going to become what is going to be the federal government's response to a state or a city that decides that they want to establish a pilot program and they want to roll forward with it.
Well, Michael Botticelli, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I say welcome to Baltimore.
Thanks. It's always good to be here. And, again, I think Baltimore is, a really good example of a city that has, I think, been leading the way on a city response to the opioid epidemic.
Michael Botticelli, former drug czar in the Obama administration, is executive director of the Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine at Boston Medical Center. He is also now a distinguished policy scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. That's our show for now. Please join us Friday for a look back 50 years with film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed to the best movies of 1967, including The Graduate and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. We welcome comments on the show. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or just send me an email at drodricks@baltsun.com. For producer Steve Early, Dan Rodericks here. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.